Did you know that research has been carried out to discover ways of controlling your every thought and desire? In a moment, what you will hear will both shock and horrify you. We've got Eldon Taylor, Mind Programming, on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon Taylor has been researching the power of the mind for the past 25-plus years and is considered to be an expert in the area of hypnosis and subliminal communication for over 10 years. Eldon specializes in criminalistics, where he supervised and conducted investigations and testing to detect deception. President Director of the Progressive Awareness Research, Inc. And here he is back on Coast to Coast after a pretty long hiatus, Eldon, huh?
Yes, I think about 10 years.
My God, where have you been in 10 years?
Continuing the research and missing Coast to Coast.
Well, I'm glad you're back. This is fascinating work. You've got to tell me and everybody else listening, what led you into this direction? Not everybody wakes up and starts to go into research the human mind the way you have.
But, you know, for all intent and purposes, I look at my life and I see a straight line. Since I was a child, I have been interested in why people do what people do. And, of course, as you said in the introduction, I found myself at a point where I was practicing criminalistics, and that included lie detection testing, forensic hypnosis, investigations, and so forth. And I would, you know, encounter situations where, for the life of me, it was very difficult to understand why people made the choices that they made. I guess, you know, I'd have to harken back to 1984 when we set a study in motion out at the Utah State Prison to look at why inmates were inmates. I mean, you could have two brothers, one that turned out to be a surgeon working in the local hospital, another who was a recidivist, a third-time offender, violent criminal. And we ran some extensive tests and came away with no big surprises. You know, we had scores, high scores, in what's known as self-alienation and social alienation. In other words, we had a population that had low self-esteem, and they exacted that against society. If I'm not worth anything, you're worth less. Kind of compensation.
Yeah.
But when we got right into talking to them one-on-one, for setting off the psychometrics, discovered that they had this ability to displace responsibility, and that ability we just call blame. That was a real turning point for me. As I began to look down that path, and maybe in the next 3 hours we'll pursue that, but as I began to look down that path, what I saw was what culminated in the book Mind Programming, a process by which an individual gives up their authentic self in favor of a rehearsed self, a practiced self, a self that they have taken on from peers, from the media, from various forms of mind influence, and thus the book Mind Programming. Because my intent there was, although I do spend some time looking at covert, surreptitious means that were done by the government, so my intent there was really to say, wake up, you know? I thought that maybe I could even retitle the book, call it something like, What Do I Believe, Why, and Who Am I After All? But, you know, it probably have a whole lot less appeal.
Yeah, well, Mind Programming tells it all. I guess you could also have said, you know, the mind is a sponge, because it seems like people who are brainwashed, and I guess we're all bombarded, they let this happen. Can they fight it? Can they stop it?
Well, the answer to that is yes. But to do that, they have to ask the big question. And that big question is, who am I? I mean, you know, yeah. I just came back from a seminar, hundreds of people, and you can ask the audience, when was the last time you had an original thought, a truly original thought? Indeed, let's just take that a little bit further. I want you to look at yourself, you know, self-examination, and tell me what there is about you that is not copied from something.
That's me?
Yeah, anybody.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you one.
I don't mean to direct that at you.
No, let me tell you
that I do put the people in seminars. Yes, sir.
Let me tell you what we did, and you tell me if this fits into that scheme, because I'm very proud of this. You know, in addition to working on Coast to Coast Monday through Friday, I do the first Sunday of every month. And I was kicking an idea around with my producer, Tom, and, you know, we came up with an idea of highlighting emerging artists, people. We run bumper songs between breaks, and you've heard that, Elton.
Right. Uh-huh.
But to give these people an opportunity who never get a chance to play their hard-earned work, their music, on radio stations. It's just going to be very difficult for them to do it.
Right.
And unlike American Idol, where there's really one winner, everybody that gets a bumper song on this program, I think, is a winner. So we decided we're going to take these emerging artists, these folks in North America who are out there, who love music, who produce CDs, and they do it because they love it, and we're going to start playing them as bumper songs on that first Sunday. And I've got to tell you, the response has been absolutely incredible. I'd like to say that's an original idea. I don't think anybody else is doing that.
No, and I would concur with you. That is a great idea. But in order for you to get that idea, and you correct me, I mean, I don't want to, you know, read your mind over the radio.
Though you're probably doing it.
But in order for you to do that, you had to step back and take a position that's uncommon. It's a position we think of as service. You know, what is it that I can do that is going to empower or to assist or to aid another? You had to move from the I-me orientation. That orientation, Thomas Hobbes tells us, is all about gain for the purpose of defense. That is, we're so fearful that we have to wrestle for power in order to stave off our fears. That selfish sense of individual that we see so much of today, that lack of civility. You had to step away from that, George.
Yes.
And you had to think conversely. You had to flip the model upside down and say, okay, what is it that I can do to give back? What is it I can do to serve? And I'd like to think, and you also correct me if I'm wrong, that when you think about that, when you put your head on the pillow at night, you get a warm, fuzzy feeling. You feel good. You feel that your life makes a difference.
Yes, and you also feel as if you're helping your fellow man.
Yeah, well, and I think that's why you feel that your life makes a difference. See, what I discovered with these inmates was, to the precise extent that they displaced responsibility, the precise extent that they blamed everybody, they literally tied themselves up. Meaning, you know, the standard answer would be something like, "Ah, oh, but for the grace of God, there go you." I mean, what would you do? I mean, my daddy was an alcoholic, my mommy was a prostitute, the neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 8 years old. And most of the stories we heard were very exaggerated. They were totally false in many instances. But the mechanism of displacing that responsibility meant that they didn't need to do anything about it. Indeed, they really couldn't do anything about it. So as opposed to taking responsibility for all of their actions or looking at what they might do in the world that would, as you just did, benefit, what they were looking at is how they got even. And we have almost this unwritten moray in our society that it's okay to get evener. And it really never has been. So you had to convolute the model, and that's part of what I try to tell people in mind programming. You have to step out of this frame of mind. May I share a story with you?
Absolutely.
Short story. Okay. I think this illustrates what we're trying to talk about, because it illustrates how easily we're confused in our day-to-day choices. So, you know, the story, imagine that you're walking down the street in a beautiful city. It's a new city to you. Maybe it's London. Maybe it's New York. You've never been there. It's a glorious day. You've always wanted to go there. Sun's shining. You're on the sidewalk. You're in a really expensive, nice area. You're passing under high-rise condos, and from the third floor balcony, a flower pot falls. Strikes you on the head, falls to the sidewalk, charred, scatter about. you have some choices. Now, I tell this story to thousands of people, and here are the three that I always get. The first one is, you know, I'm going to take this pot, these broken pieces, I'm taking it up to that third floor, and I'm putting them you know where.
Yep.
Of course, if you get up there and it's a lineman for the New York Giants, maybe you change your mind.
Kind of shuffle back a little.
Yeah. You know, the second one is, I'm going to sue this guy. You know, I mean, hey, after all, they should know better than this. What if it was a baby passing underneath?
Uh-huh,
I mean,
uh-huh.
You know, this could be whiplash, da-da-da.
Let's teach him a lesson.
Yeah. And hey, you know, I was talking to a radio host. I have to add this one in Detroit not long ago, and he said, I'm going to do number one and number two.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And, you know, and the third one is, well, I'm going to be metaphysical. You know, I'm just not going to let this ruin my day. I'm just going to ignore it. I mean, it's an abrasion, a little bump. It bothers me some. But, you know, I'm going to go on having a great day, and that's the end of this. And we can look at that and say that's a form of denial, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's true. Then you ask the audience, and what else is it you would do? And you all, I always get these blank looks, these blank stares, and it's, well, like what? Is there something else that you might do? Well, maybe you pick up the flower, take it to the florist, repot it.
Save it.
Now, maybe you take it home and keep it. That'd be okay. But maybe even you take it back to the owner. You know, you knock on their door, hey, your flower fell, hit me on the head. You probably ought to be a little more careful with it. But I didn't want it to die, so I repotted it.
And
I hope
it is.
The pot. Now, of all those things, when you get to the end of the day, you put your head on the pillow, which one's going to make you feel the best?
Of course, the one where you give him the pot with the little flower in
it. Now, here's the secret.
It should.
Yeah, it should, because what happens when you do that is... Your body, I mean, just selfishly, okay? Your body is bathed with all these wonderful neurochemicals. Those chemicals that are the natural endorphins that just make us feel good. And our bodies essentially have two budgets analogous to a government. We have a budget for defense. We have a budget for growth. So I have the body in the budget for growth. If I put the body in the budget for defense, well, I interrupt the optimal operation of my ANS, my immune, my endocrine. Next thing I know, I'm vulnerable for this, that, and the other, and I'm sick. So just from a selfish standpoint, if we were to think of it only that way, changing slightly how we look at life can make a huge difference in what we realize our lives to be.
Good point. Now, but that's with an individual. Your work with mind programming tells us that there are others out there trying to bombard us, trying to change us, and manipulate us.
You know, that's a fact, and there's no way we're going to get away from that. We, you know, if you really look at the subject, brainwashing, mind programming, you'll find skeptical definitions that say enculturation, process is not mind programming. However, if you look at the influence of enculturation processes, it clearly is mind programming. Most of us are raised in what I think of as a no-don't syndrome. We don't have a rite of passage, and we're told we're not old enough or we're not smart enough or you know, our peers will tell us that we're stupid, we're ugly, we're fat, we're skinny. Our laugh is peculiar, our hair is. We've all heard all these stories. Well, when we take that aboard, it's painful. And so what we do psychologically is develop adaptive mechanisms, defense strategies to avoid that pain and to maximize our pleasure in life. And sometimes they're compensatory. What we don't do is come to a point where we ever look at them and graduate from them. So those mechanisms that we may employ when we're children, we take completely through our life. And often they self-sabotage us. So to me, it begins there. But it gets a whole lot more malevolent. We can have parents that have the best intent, and we can have parents whose intent is, well, I'll just say confused. But it the net result is it's very hurtful. But then we also have those people that just totally want to manipulate us, you know. Somebody the other day asked me, George, they said, how long has there been an overt effort to really control our minds, discounting mom and dad?
I would say since we've had humans on this planet.
Yeah, and that's the answer. But, you know, 80 years ago, we got really sophisticated about it because along came Sigmund Freud, and what most people don't recognize is Freud had a nephew, and the nephew probably has impacted us more than Sigmund Freud because the nephew saw these unconscious mechanisms that his uncle called out and thought, how could I, what could I employ to manipulate a person unconsciously, subconsciously? Man's name was Edward Bernays, and, you know, we know him today as the father of propaganda.
Yes.
And, you know, it was Bernays that said it was the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the habits and opinions of the masses that was the duty of the elite in a democratic society. Indeed, I think his quote went something like, we have to manipulate them, or you won't be able to govern them. We have to control and mold their minds, their tastes, and give them the ideas they're going to have. Otherwise, we won't be able to conduct a social society. We won't be able to have ethical thinking, et cetera. So what Bernays set out to do, and that paraphrase is from his book Propaganda, what he set out to do was sophisticate marketing. And to do that, scientific marketing, he employed some sophisticated biofeedback means. And we began to look at how the body responded to questions, how the body responded to stimuli. Well, today that's known as neuromarketing, and neuromarketing incorporates the use of functional magnetic resonance imaging, positron emission tomography. It's very, very sophisticated. And we know as a case in point, as a result of utilizing that technology, that the warning on a cigarette pack, the Surgeon General's warning on a cigarette pack, actually excites precisely the same area in the brain, the nucleus accumbens, that is excited due to addictions.
And due to addictions, right.
So what we have is that is probably the best advertisement that tobacco companies could run, because when a smoker sees it, they have to have a cigarette.
It's almost like telling your kid, don't do it. They end up doing it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, don't touch wet paint. We've all seen that.
Exactly. And let me ask you this too, Eldon, that in the old days when they would behead some criminal in a public square and everybody would be gathered around to see this horrifying event, they, of course, took care of the criminal. But weren't they also sending a message to the population, don't get out of control here, folks?
Well, I think that's true. There's no question about that. But there's also a lot to be said about what that kind of violence does. Let me bring that around to our era.
All right.
If we look at the media today and we compare the media to, say, 1950, there's a shocking difference by way of the level of stimulation that is made available, both in violent nature and its sexual content.
And technology as well.
And technology, absolutely. And the technology is key because, as you know, you can do lots of things with the speed of the frames and the movie, mm-hmm. and so forth. So, and technology. Well, what we have now is a time when, if I look back to the 50s, I might take my gun to school and in seventh period go out with a teacher and we might actually all shoot together. Today,
the BB gun, you mean?
Yeah, well, even at 22. But today,
really?
You're going to have a SWAT team there.
You're
in a
done.
Minute.
You're arrested, you're expelled, and they've arrested you. You're gone.
That's right.
Eldon, we're going to take this quick break and we're going to come right back with you. This is fascinating. Mind programming. Eldon Taylor, our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Eldon Taylor, our guest, Mind Programming. Eldon, we'll talk about some more of these analogies of why people get their minds programmed and why they do it. But let me pick your brain for just a moment.
Okay.
During this current economic mess we're in, I think one of the major factors for the downturn is the public's perception of defeat. So, you know, General Motors, for example, quarterly revenues down 47% because people said, I'm not going to buy these cars. They may not be in business. I'm not going to have a warranty. And this perception just multiplied and multiplied. If people were just calm, or if government made it seem calm, I think people would have gotten the economy going a little better. It's not to say the greed with the mortgage business and everything else contributed. But what happened to the public mind in terms of collectively putting us in a position we're in now?
Okay. You know, first of all, I totally concur with your analysis. I mean, we hear that this is a subprime collapse or a collapse due to subprime loans, and they may well have a good deal to do with the housing market. But we really have a consumer confidence problem more than we have anything else.
Yes.
And it is, you know, that lack of consumer confidence has been fed by the news cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That news cycle is there 24/7, searching for something that is noteworthy, and almost always that tends to be the sensational, the fearful, etc. So, you know, we live at a day and age where a hiccup is not a hiccup anymore. You know, it's a major event. And this event, not unlike any other kind of mass hysteria, has for all intent and purposes convinced the American people that we may be entering the Great Depression of our time. Now, it's only been recently that we start seeing some news and some forecasters are saying, you know, I think we've hit the bottom, we're turning the corner, we're not going to have a major depression. But if you harken back just 3 months ago, that was the forecast. We had a newly elected president that was in front of us on a pretty regular basis telling us this was the worst economic times of our time.
Yes.
Now, you know, I hate to get political. I don't want to get political. But when you hear from White House executives words like this is too good a crisis to pass up, and you understand that that basically is the signal that now is the time for us to do all the things that we want to do,
mm-hmm.
Because we can justify that in the name of crisis. You have to look at that as an informed citizen and say there's more to this than what the general public is paying attention to. But then the general public doesn't pay attention. That's part of the problem, George. You know, you honestly, we have a society that is filled with the need for stimulation. You, before we went to break, you had asked me about public execution.
Right. Let's go to that.
And I said, if we just brought that into today, and we look at the difference between 1950 and today, what we can see is a clear pattern. And the pattern that emerges is this. The media, more than anyone, but all forms of our entertainment, all forms of how, I mean, even our education, is intent on capturing our attention. In order to do that, it has to deliver something that piques an arousal, causes an arousal. That level of stimulation must increase systematically because as we receive more and more stimuli, our threshold of arousal raises, requiring even more stimuli. So a Marilyn Monroe passing over some air vent and having her skirt fly in the air is about as scintillating as closing your thumb in a car door today. It just doesn't do it.
That's a good point.
So what happens, and I have observed this in every area. What happens, and has happened in our country, is we've kind of adapted a fifth drive. You know, I call it that mind programming, because that's what we see it. You know, in Psych 101, as you remember, you're taught there are four drives: fight, flight, feeding, and propagation of the species. Well, the fifth drive is more. More. I want more. I want more money. I want more power. I want more cars. I want more women. I want more men.
More everything.
More. And if you look at young children today, everything to them is more. There's never such a thing as enough.
And keeping up. They come home from school and they've got this pressure. They've got to have the right tennis shoes. They've got to have this and that.
That's exactly right. And all of that has been sold to us. And what we're pursuing is what? I mean, when you get right down to it, what is this stuff? You know, in the end, it's stuff. It's just stuff. We have inauthenticated ourselves, given ourselves over to some counterfeit being that we think of as ourselves, because we have taken on the pursuit of all this stuff that everybody tells us we have to have in order to be happy, we have to have in order to be whole, we have to have, and so what we see in this current consumer confidence collapse, if you will, is this fear. And, of course, you know, a lot of people don't understand that advertisers want to sell you fear just as much as everybody else does, because there's great opportunities in it. If I can sell you fear, I can sell you a solution. But we have this fear that maybe all the good times are going away. And that fear has forced, if you will, a sort of hysteria. And that it isn't a lot different than this. In my book, I recount how groups behave, and we do behave collectively in groups. And I tell several, you know, actual incidents, but the one that comes to my mind is the school teacher who smells gasoline around a 50-gallon drum that has, like, a skull and bones indicating that it might be radioactive.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? And immediately, she's sure that this is something left over from the Second World War, it's in the basement, you know, da-da-da. She reacts to it. Her body breaks out. She tells everybody what it is. There's over 100 people from that school in the hospital that evening, all with the same symptoms.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This is a 50-gallon drum of water, as it turns out. You see,
it's like the
you
placebo.
You remember restless leg syndrome?
Yep.
When the patent was there, and it was all over TV, and this is documented, the incident of restless leg syndrome just blew through the roof. Take it off of television, it once again disappeared.
Why does the mind work collectively, then?
Well, you know,
What happened to the individual?
I think what happens, first of all, is we've given ourselves over, but to look at that, you have to digress and have to say, what is it that we trust in the world? Well, let's see. We trust our senses, but they're not all that reliable. And we could get into that if you want. I can show you that your senses will betray you as often as not. We trust authority, you know, the advice, the television ads, the doctor. In fact, there's new research that shows when the authority is there, if we're actually scanning your brain, the area of the brain that makes choices, makes decisions, shuts down, just turns off.
And accepts, right?
That's right. I mean, it literally, you're looking at an area of the brain that is lit up, if you will, and it goes dark. All right?
That's dangerous.
Oh, no kidding. And then we have all these really implicit assumptions, biases, and contexts that are so built in. You know, one of my favorite stories there is one Jesse Jackson tells. Reverend Jesse Jackson admits to his chagrin that he understands that his own biases still sway him. And he explains that this way. He remembers walking back to a hotel. It's after dark. He hears footsteps approaching from behind. They're coming rapidly and heavy. He turns quickly because he's frightened.
Sure.
And he's relieved. It's a white man.
Jeez.
Now, that is quite a bias for a Jesse Jackson to have. And what we know is we all have these biases. In fact, You can go, your listening audience can get on the internet, go out there. The Harvard implicit bias tests are available, and you can look at all the different biases, whether they're age or race or sex or et cetera. But we all have those. And then we have the context framing. We don't even stop to think that we're unable to think. We're limited in our thinking. You know, you hear think out of the box, but hey, listen, try this, you know? A couple of stories.
Be edgy. People need to be edgy. Go ahead with the stories.
Yeah. Somebody comes to your door. It's 9 o'clock at night. You're still home. You're not doing coast to coast. Somebody you know, George, they knock on your door. They say, you know, look, I'm in a scavenger hunt. If you've got a 3x7 piece of wood, I can win $10,000. You think, I haven't got a wood pile or anything. Hey, I'll split it with you if you've got that. Gee, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And you close your 3x7 wood door. We get trapped in how we think. Here's one I really love. You and I are doing the radio right now. You think of the saliva in your mouth. Think of how good it is to have it, because if it's, we're not talking if we go dry.
I have foamed once in a while, though.
Do you?
Okay.
Yeah,
I do that.
All right. But it tastes good, feels good. Ask the listening audience. Think about it. Roll it around in your mouth.
No. Stop. Right? You're killing me.
Now I want you to imagine you just have a clear shot glass, and you're just going to spit that saliva into that shot glass, okay? Got it in the glass? Now I want you to imagine, knock it back. Just drink it back down. Something changes, doesn't it?
You need help, Elton.
When it's in your mouth, it's good. When it's in that shot glass, separated by a tenth of a second, it's vile.
It's because you can see it.
Why? Because you can see it?
Well, that's one reason.
I don't know that I would accept that, George. We have a context.
We have a perception of, I guess,
right,
of what it is.
And those perceptions frame our every judgment, our every decision, our every thought. And they've been voiced on us.
And some people have good perceptions, others don't, right?
That's correct. No question about that. But in order to get good perception, you have to become responsible enough to train yourself to get good perceptions.
True.
And even at that, then you have to understand that we believe that we're making our choices. We believe that consciously we're making our decisions. But the research shows us, has shown us since the mid-50s, and it's been verified over and over again, but Benjamin Libet originally did this work, shows us that areas of the unconscious become excited before we make a motor movement or we say a word. In other words, if we're making a choice, we've already made it in the unconscious. And the unconscious is now going to put it forward for us. And further, with respect to that, we know that I can prime you in a way. Let's say I can put the word angry over a face of an individual I'm going to introduce you to. Now, I'm going to flash this word angry, or I'm going to put a big frown over this face, but I'm going to do it with a tachyscope so that it's subliminal. It's 1/300th of a second. You're not even going to know that it's there. I'm going to give you a half a dozen of these exposures, and then I'm going to introduce you to the person. And when I do, you're not going to like them. You're going to report to me that, you just weren't comfortable with them. But you're going to make up a reason for why.
You have no idea, but you make them up.
You have no idea, but you have to make up a reason. You can't just say to me, well, I have no idea why I didn't like him. Well, he looked like my uncle, and I had a bad. You're going to make up a reason for the decision that you made. Now, when you add all of that together, and we're just getting in the beginning of this, you can already see how important it is to stop and come back and start peeling off some layers, looking at who am I really? What am I here for? What is it I want out of life? What are my real possibilities and potentials? And until and unless we do that, we go through life asleep.
That's pretty good. That is pretty good. Now, these people who are trying to manipulate and control us, have they studied this? Is there a science behind it? Or are they just rolling the dice?
No. Billions and billions of dollars. The
no
marketing
mistakes.
People have spent billions of dollars. They have it down to a total science. In fact,
sometimes they don't do it right.
No, well, they do and they don't. They still make mistakes, but the mistakes could be, you know, they're not based on their science as much as they're based on what we call swag, you know, scientific wild guess, okay? And you know what the A stands for, all right? We have, you know, you have those marketers that are in the vein of a Sigmund Freud. They're going to work and tweak on the subconscious. I started to tell you I reproduce in my book, Mind Programming, parts of a training manual that were sent to me. It's actually an advertising training manual. And this training manual shows a couple of real ads that have appeared nationally everywhere that have, in one instance, death and dying themes, giant spiders and whatnot created in it to heighten anxiety. But they're also selling a product that is considered to be a product that can cause a death. And they sell an awful lot of those products. This is an old cigarette ad. The other one is a liquor ad, and that ad is full of sexual embeds. The overall theme of these two, both of them Freud and in their nature, is to heighten the sense of arousal, which increases, you know, in advertising they say you have a third of a second to stop them and 3 seconds to read them.
Yeah.
So you know, it stops you. It creates that sense of arousal, and yet you don't know why this material is hidden in such a way that we think of it as subliminal, and at the same time that it's doing that, it's also creating a satisfaction. So it is building an anxiety, building a need, creating a fear, and then satisfying that need or that fear, all at an unconscious level. Then you have the straight-up stuff that comes at you. You know, the Marlboro Man, everybody wants to be a cowboy. The Gerber Baby, everybody loves
a little kid.
Yeah. You know, yeah. But our situation, and we need that. You know, I mean, we do need marketing, so I'm not pounding on marketing. But what we as consumers need to do is realize that this is a very sophisticated science and that we're being plied with it every day.
And what is amazing to me, Eldon, is the fact that we are being molded, and it seems to work.
It does work, and we are being molded. You know, I mean, look. And the molding can be really obvious. It can just stick you smack in the face. And lots of people will just know, you know, just ignore it. Let me give you an example when you say that. And I know we've got a break coming up.
30 seconds. Do you want to wait?
I'll wait till after the break because this is the National Security's Domestic Extremism Dictionary.
Oh, my gosh. And by the way, Mind Programming, where do you get it? Is it out?
Oh, the book is out. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, any brick-and-mortar bookstore, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books a Million online. It's actually doing very well. The book club picked it up.
Oh, it's a great read.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
EldonTaylor.com is the website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. We'll be back in a moment as we talk about reverse speech, subliminal suggestions as well, mind control and brainwashing on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon, right before the top of the hour break, we were talking about mind programming, and you were mentioning something about national security. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, you'd made the point that we're molded every day and in every way. And what I wanted to say is, even in our definitions, if you think about it, the nature of the dialogue that we have today, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, has changed dramatically. And as it's changed, it's been a matter of the definitions. So here was it last week, the national security people released what they called the Domestic Extremism Dictionary. And I'm sure you heard all about this, George. I'm sure you probably had lots of phone calls. But for all intent and purposes, this dictionary targeted returning vets as potentially a domestic security problem. It also targeted pro-lifers. In fact, it appeared to be written as though it were aimed at targeting many conservative values. Now, I don't want to take a political side on this, but I just want to point this out. Let's assume that you're on the fence. Let's assume that, you know, you're thinking about joining the NRA, but the NRA is named as an extremist potential, a national security risk. What happens is you make a decision that I don't want anything to do with that. I'm going to step over here. Now, you don't even stop to think why these definitions were created, whether they're correct or they're incorrect. You just accept the fact that, well, I don't want to be labeled that way.
Okay.
And you change your position. And if you think about that, the power of those labels, they're actually used by everyone every day. And for example, we have...
That's how you character assassinate someone.
Well, it is, absolutely. It goes even deeper than that. We have a conflict in Congress today, and it's about secret ballots and unions. On one side, we have the Employee Free Choice Act. Okay?
All right.
Now, that sounds like free choice, like I get to make my decision, you know, all by myself, the privacy of my mind, not under any pressure, et cetera, right? But that's not what that is. That is no more secret ballot. And it versus the other side, Save Our Secret Ballot Act. You see? So in these labels, the entire matter becomes confused, to say the least. So, and every day, those labels are placed on us, and we place those labels on other people, and, you know, we begin to assume that, well, the label has to be correct, and we fall into the politically correct way of doing things, and we never stop to question any of it. Now, hopefully, all of it is marching us to where we want to be. It's marching us to a more civil society. Although, as we talked earlier, you know, when you desensitize an individual's threshold of arousal, these public executions, to the amount of murder and mayhem that we see in the news, etc. Indeed, this is worth pointing out. The average 18-year-old today has seen 200,000 hours of television and over 30,000 murders.
And these video games as well.
And that's, well, hey, they're practice killers. There's no other way to put it. You know, you take a couple of people that haven't shot a gun much, you put them on a knoll outside a school in Columbine, and let them start turning loose firearms, and they never miss.
But why? So, Eldon?
Because
why?
Because they've been doing it in arcades.
Now, but let me ask you this. When we were kids,
Yeah. You
and me were almost about the same age.
Okay.
We would run around and play cowboys and Indians. Remember?
Absolutely.
We'd have
Absolutely.
Cap guns. We'd point them at our friends. I never went on to shoot anybody.
No. And neither did I.
So why does it affect others and not others?
What was the difference in our civilities? You know, when we were kids, you could have a fist fight. And when you were done, you could shake hands with whoever you had that fist fight with and go on and be friends.
Except the bully.
Well, except the bully.
The bully.
Okay? But today, we have made it so... What we have done is... We're all familiar with the minister. I'm not going to use anybody's name, but we're all familiar with the minister that tells you sex is the greatest evil in the world. You'll go to hell for it, et cetera, that then runs out and has sex
and does
with
what
prostitutes, et cetera. We all understand that the repression of those drives, the repression of that material, can actually attract us to that. We have a large part of that going on in our culture right now. We're repressing every physical outlet that a young person might have. And more these young people aren't participating in the physical activities. They're in front of computers. They're in front of their handheld computer games, their Nintendos, and all that other. Or they're in an arcade, or they're on their telephones, and they're messaging each other. You don't see young people doing what we did as kids. But in addition to that, I didn't see 30,000 murders on television. Neither did you.
Nope.
So my values with respect to life were a little different. You know, when you take young people today. It's not uncommon to sit down maybe a 10 or a 12-year-old and ask him how many pets they have and have them tell you, well, I have two. There's my dog, you know, Fido at home, and then I have a cat in my RuneScape game named Jesse. In other words, this 10 or 12-year-old has two pets. He doesn't make any distinction between the fact that one isn't really living.
Yeah, one's it's a virtual, cyber cat. Yeah,
you know, and the other one is living. There is a desensitization, a divorcing, literally, of the values of life.
Here's an analogy I use. Listen to this. You'll love this.
Good.
Former NFL football player retires, goes into sales for a company. He's 6'5". He's doing very well, very successful, except with one company. He has to sell one guy who's the buyer of this business, and the guy's 5'5". Every time he walked into his office, he would never get the sale. The guy was always polite to him, but he would never buy, and it just rocked this guy. He couldn't understand it. So one day he was, you know, out to dinner with his buddy, and he said, what am I doing wrong? And his friends asked him questions about the guy. And he said, well, he's a nice guy, but, you know, he's running this business. And, you know, he's 5'5". He said, wait a minute. You're 6'5". You walk into his office, and you intimidate him. So this is what you're going to do. So the next day he had an appointment. He walks into the guy's office. He's got his briefcase, which it's open, but he's holding it, all right? The guy didn't know it was open. He fakes a fall, and he falls on the floor. The briefcase opens. All the guy's sales papers go scattering all over this guy's office, and he just lies there on the floor. The little guy gets up from behind his desk, helps this 6'5" football player up, dusts him off, puts his papers in his briefcase for him. They sit down and talk. He walks out with sale.
Yep.
And he always had sales after that with the guy.
Yep.
He made him comfortable.
Absolutely right. It's a marvelous, marvelous story to illustrate. Had our 6'5" guy rolled in on a wheelchair, would have had the same effect.
Would have had the same effect. Would have got the sale.
That's right. You know, and the people that do that kind of thing, the salesmen, the marketers, they know how those compliance principles work, and that's one of them, and they will apply it. You know, we have this need for self-identification, self-representation, and you know, everybody's heard of the Caesar complex, the short person's complex, and not Caesar.
Napoleon,
thank you. And your example is a good one. You've got a leader. The leader sees himself as being in control, being in charge, and in comes this guy 6'5", and that's intimidating to anyone. I mean, so that's a very good one.
Years ago, there was a television group. I'm not going to mention its proper name. I started in the infancy of TV. I mean, way back in the 60s. And this executive, and this company was notorious. But this CEO would sit in one of those barber chairs where you could pump up and you'd go up. So people would come and sit in his office, and they'd in his chair, the chair you would sit in, Eldon, would be intentionally small.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd sit there, and your knees would be together, and you'd be like down low, be almost eye level with his desk.
Mm-hmm.
And before you came in, he'd pump his chair up, and he'd be looking down on you. And he just intimidated people. They hated the guy. Why would he do that?
Power. Power. That's all about power.
Why does he get the power with respect?
Books written on that, like The Territorial Imperative. There was a book by James Drott called The Secret for a long time. It was kind of the underground manual that people in business employed. And it included the tactic, just like you're describing. It included the tactic of where you take over the table. You just kind of spread your material around. Because what that does is it tends to intimidate the other person. If what you're seeking to do is intimidate the other person, that's a great means. if you're insecure with your authority, you're probably going to do something like that. If you have a subordinate that threatens you because they're smarter than you, or, you know, you're apt to do that. Lots of those kinds of things used to go on, but they all led to what we came to know as the Peter Principle, too.
Yeah.
A good leader doesn't do that, you know. A good leader like a Jack Welch or a Lee Iacocca, they don't need to pump up any chairs.
That's right.
And they don't need you to get down on your knees and fake a fall.
That's true.
But those are people that have also taken the time to do what we're talking about, to get to that place where they really know who they are. They've really examined what their thoughts are and what their limitations are and what the alternatives are. These are what we call today authentic people, and there aren't too many of them.
Mind control, mind programming, beyond, let's say, business, is being done on a regular basis on populations. Here's a perfect example, whether you agree with me or not in this one. I said weeks ago that this swine flu situation was not going to be a pandemic. It was hype. And, you know, I stuck my neck out, and I'm going to say I was right.
No, and I think you are right. And what's more, I'll add some paranoia to it for you, George. When those things happen, what goes through my mind is, if they want me to look this direction, what is it they're doing over here that I'm not looking at? You know,
precisely.
You're going to show me the left hand. What do you got in the right hand?
Yeah.
you know, when this whole thing broke out, I have a very good friend that is the equivalent to what would be our Surgeon General in Mexico, or past Surgeon General, Agustin Diaz Lopez. And from his BlackBerry, he notified me of what was happening in Mexico. And if you follow this at all, you know that, well, one day you have 125 deaths, and the next day, you know, if you turned your back, 2 days later, there are 12 deaths.
Yeah, exactly.
What happened to all the others in between,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
What I saw in the news cycle was quite different than what I was getting from Diaz Lopez's BlackBerry. You know, I said to my wife, you know, I don't know what's going on here, but this is not a straight-up kosher There's something else behind the scenes on this, and I think you called it dead on, but I'll come back and say to you then, why? Because that's what disturbs me. Why? I mean, why would we do this? Why would we alarm everyone?
What's the next step?
Yeah. See, there's a huge impact on the economy there.
See, if it's mind control, if it's brainwashing, there's a bigger plan, isn't there?
Yep, that would be the scheme, you know, again, we get people to march in cadence for two reasons, their appetite and their fear. And
but what about the boy who cried wolf syndrome? What happens there?
Well, see, I don't think you can have a situation with this particular matter that is going to be a boy cried wolf. I think what we're going to probably see is a lot of conversation about you know, the virus is going to lay down for the summer. That's not unlike the pandemic of 1929, I guess it was.
1918.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep.
It laid down for the summer, and then it came back winter with a virulence that killed millions of people. Do you have that number available also?
Well, worldwide, millions is pretty, that's pretty accurate.
So I think that's what we're going to hear. And then will we have a new flu next year? Well, we always have new flus. And will the flu turn out to be a pandemic of the kind that takes lives? I remember the last swine flu. I'm old enough to remember that one. They rushed out all the inoculations, and the inoculation itself.
And we didn't have the kind of media we have today.
No, we don't. That was in the 70s.
Yeah. But,
you know, I mean, again, that wasn't the flu itself didn't hurt people like the cure did.
Yeah.
So, I look at something like that, and I think you're 100% right. The question for me though is, what is the plan? Why is that going on? Where I mean, what is to be gained out of this crisis? What additional control? I think.
And it's the same as weapons of mass destruction.
It is. It exactly. That's exactly what I had in my mind. You know, the Patriot Act. Arguably, that keeps us safer. Arguably, also, it is the surrendering of a lot of our civil rights in the name of a crisis.
Fear allows you to do a lot of things, Eldon.
It does. It absolutely does. It is the motivator, if you will. And you know, when you look at how all these things tie together, again, you've got to come back and say, is there a point that as human beings, we're not going to turn off our brains and give over everything to the authority? Is there a point where we're not going to, in the name of consistency, just comply? You know, one of the real compliance principles is consistency. We have the need to be consistent. So let's just say we elect a leader and then we become disenchanted with what the leader does. Well, it's going to take a lot of disenchantment before we'll move away from that leader or begin to say, now, wait a minute, I don't like that, because we've already invested ourselves in them. Back in the lie detection days, and this is a great example, I think, when I used to give lie detection, whenever anybody gives a lie detection test, what you have is what we call pre-stress or control questions. So we have to be able to look at neutrals, you know, is your name George Nuri?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be able to look at pre-stress, where we know there's stress in the question, so that we can compare that to the relevant.
Yes.
And hopefully the relevant has less.
You know, it's like going into your doctor, your blood pressure's always up.
That's right.
And then he's got to get a basis for that before he knows if it's really up.
That's exactly right. But we want more than situational stress, because that's going to be across all the questions. So what I might do in a situation like that, George, is I might ask you, you know, have you ever lied to anyone that trusted? I mean, I know that you're an honest person. You've come here to tell me the truth today. So you don't look like a person that would lie to someone that trusted you. Did you lie to someone that trusted you? Now, most people are going to say no, because in order to be consistent with, I'm here to take a lie detection test and here to prove that I'm honest, I have to say no.
Let's pick it up right from there when we come back. Plus, we will get into subliminal and reverse speech. By the way, our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland, he does these things for me. 20 million died in the 1918 pandemic. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, we're talking about lie detector tests. And after we get through some of the things you're talking about, I want to ask you a question about a fellow by the name of Travis Walton. But go ahead.
Okay. What we were talking about actually was our need to comply. And one of the compliance principles is consistency. And how it's taken advantage of by, you know, anyone and everyone that knows about it. So, as I was explaining, you might come in for a lie detection test, and I would need a control question, and I would set up one of various scenarios to get the control question, but they would always work around what we call this principle of consistency. So I would ask you, you know, I mean, I'd set up the scenario by essentially saying, do you plan to be honest today? And of course, you'd say yes. And I'd say, well, all right, you look like an honest person. I assume you're here to tell me the truth. I mean, there'd be no other reason to come in here. So I'm on your team. I'm here to help prove your innocence. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions today. Among those questions, I'm going to ask you if you're an honest person, but I'm going to ask it this way. Did you ever lie to someone that trusted you? Because you don't strike me as somebody that had lied to someone that trusted you.
Okay, and if I lied, if I came in there intentionally to lie, why would I even come in? Because I have to assume the lie detector test is going to find out.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to ask myself that too, George, because I've got to tell you, lots of them come in, and they believe that they can beat the test. They believe they've read something about a countermeasure. They've got a thumbtack in their shoe. They're going to crimp down their sphincter muscle. They have their countermeasures all rehearsed out. Maybe they even, you know, have done some self-hypnosis. But a good examiner will take all that away from them in a hurry. I can remember.
But it's not admissible in court, right?
Well, it depends. By stipulation, yes. But there, you know, a lie detection test is really an interrogation technique. That's what we have to understand. That's what they were developed for. They lead to confessions. You may stipulate that it's admissible. Sometimes law enforcement will tell you, well, if you pass the test, we may just send you home.
Right.
So there are lots of reasons to get you to take it, but what we're looking for is not the test saying you did or you didn't. What we're looking for is the amount of information that can be gained through that interrogation technique.
Which turns law enforcement loose to try to nail the guy, because then they may believe he's guilty.
Well, yeah, and you'd be surprised how many of them are guilty, you
right.
know. Fact of the matter is, if you have a half a dozen people, let's say you have a burglary in a business from a business safe, and there's no outside entry that could have been made based on...
And eight people had keys.
Yeah. So what you're going to do is you're going to test all eight people. Now, one of these eight people took the money, and they're not going to say, oh, I'm not taking the test, because that's too self-incriminating.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to try and beat the test in the process. But my point wasn't so much about the test. It was about your need to comply. So out of compliance, you would likely say, no, I don't lie to anybody that trusted me. And even if you did say, well, yes, you know, I once I lied to my mother, or, you know, then I was just going to change the question and say, okay, other than that one lie that you're telling me about, or other than these lies, you're not the kind of person that would lie to somebody that trusted you. What I'm looking to do out of consistency is get you to admit that, no, you're not going to lie to me, because, I mean, you're going to be consistent with that, and that creates a pre-stress. In research, we know this. If I can get you to put a decal in your front window, say a Greenpeace decal, and I come back a month later and ask you to put a small sign, like a real estate for sale sign, but the sign supports Greenpeace, you are 10 times more likely to put the sign in your yard once you put the decal in your window.
Interesting.
See?
Interesting.
So we just have these principles, these functions. You know, I call them compliance principles. I spell them out. There are about 20 of them. 12 that work on us every day like this in everything that we decide.
Is it a lie if you're at a party and a woman comes up to you and says, hey, George, how do you like my dress? And it's the worst thing you've ever seen. And you say, God, you look great on this thing. You look, it just looks great on you. It does. Now, that's a lie, right?
Yeah, that's a philosopher's conundrum. That's what that is. You know, look. I think the book says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. When you look at lies, you know, if you're a lie detection examiner, I would say to you, George, you know, there's only 100% truth. There's no such thing as 99% truth. You either tell the truth or you don't. I mean, if you think about it, do you want your wife to be 99% faithful?
No. No,
I would think
exactly.
But if you look at it, from a philosophical standpoint, you always have that question, you know. You arrive at the hospital, your mother and father have been in an automobile accident, heaven forbid. One of them has passed over. The physician says, whatever you do when you see your mother, don't tell her that your father is dead. It'll kill her. So, and the first thing out of your mother's mouth is, how's your dad? You know, it isn't as simple as that.
Good point.
So,
good point.
You know, it's a philosopher's conundrum. Travis, who are
you? Yeah, let me ask you this. Now, I don't know if you're familiar. Do you remember the movie and the book called Fire in the Sky at all? It's about a logger who, with his buddies, was out there on the West Coast, and he saw a beam of light. He got out of his truck. Went running to it. His buddies are yelling at him, don't do it, don't do it. And he got hit by that beam of light. He collapsed. They thought he was dead. They panicked. They left him. He was gone for 3 days. he comes back with this incredible story that he was abducted by aliens in a UFO. He passes lie detector tests. They then give the other loggers, his buddies, this true story. They give them lie detector tests. What happened, you know, I mean, they didn't know that he got abducted, but they saw some of the things that happened.
Right.
They passed the test. Does this mean this is indeed a true story?
Well, what it means is this person truly believes it. You know, when you say that, I think this all happened back in the 70s somewhere in Arizona, didn't it?
I think it was more up near Washington. I'm going to get the exact
was
spot.
It? Okay. But what it reminds me of, I'll just share this with you. There was a point in time that I had a dear friend come to me, and he said, you know, Eldon, do you know anything about channeling? I said, well, you know, I know a little bit about it. Why? And he says, well, I think I'm channeling. Now, this dear friend was a chair of a chemistry department at a major university, a Sorbonne fellow. His dream had been to win a Nobel Prize. So channeling, you know, well, it turns out, you know, he channels still to this day. He channels several entities, and these entities come into him. And
you're right. It was Arizona.
Okay. I got lucky. See,
yeah,
you had the 1918, not the 1929.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
Yeah, I should have known that.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. Hey, anyhow, you know what? I have fun doing this with you, George Nuri. You are a great person to interview someone. Now, with that out of the way.
I'm going to strap you up to a polygraph. No, I'm kidding.
No, that's fine. You can do that. So, anyway, I thought about writing a book called Voices of the Gods, because at the same time I had this friend telling me he was channeling, and I was suspicious of that, I had a client in my investigation business. It was a major channel, all over television, all over everywhere, that calls me on the phone and says, I have an opportunity to make this business investment. These people are flying into LAX. I've got to meet them. I've got to deliver the money. And I have a peculiar feeling. And I, you know, I'd like you to check this out for me before I give them the money. And, you know, I can't ask this entity that I'm channeling, because that's just not kosher. You know, that's about money.
Right.
And that, you know, triggers some suspicion in me. Okay. So I thought, you know, what a good book could it be to just go around and give lie detection tests to all these channels. And just about then, we had the Lafferty boys in Utah have God speak to them. And so they killed their sister-in-law, according to the instructions of God. Now, because we were doing some work at the prison system, I knew people at the prison system, I can tell you this, that these two young men absolutely, totally, unequivocally believed God spoke to them and told them to do this.
Jeez.
So I never ran. I never went with the book. I never ran the lie detection test, because it became clear to me that what we're looking at is what they truly believe. And if they truly believe that, then the lie detection test isn't going to do anything. And I'm going to come back and tell you again that, you know, a good lie detection test is an interrogation method. It isn't simply a question of were you abducted on this day? Were you gone for 3 days? There has to be all that other complement
right.
that would go with that.
And you see a pattern there then, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm sure that in this instance he didn't get that, because he isn't a criminal suspect, so you're not really going to interrogate the man.
Yeah. Now, you know, we hired a polygraph examiner several months ago for one of our guests. The guy came on the air, and he talked about how he had a picture of an alien looking through a window, his daughter's bedroom window.
Uh-huh.
And you could see this very bizarre-looking figure. Now, to me, it looked like a cutout. But nonetheless, he claims that he saw it, and it ran away. Okay? And there was video of this thing. So it was kind of weird. Anyways, I asked him if he'd be willing to take a polygraph test. And he said, yes. So we arranged it with a pretty good polygraph examiner out of Denver, and the guest went and got wired up, and the results came back, and the polygraph examiner said, I don't think he's telling the truth about this story.
Deception
he
indicated.
Basically said he failed the test. He lied. He said he failed the test. Now, yeah, the guy came back, though, and said that he was on medication, the individual. I was on medication, on this and that, so I'm sure it affected this, and I wasn't happy with the questions. Regardless, I'm not sure it really happened.
You know, and the examiner makes a big difference, but if you have a DI chart or deception indicated chart, you have no reason to believe the person. I mean, first of all, what you have in a polygraph is just a sophisticated form of biofeedback. And if there's that kind of distress in relevant questions, there's something behind the distress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a properly, you know, structured test takes things like situational stress, drugs, da-da-da, into consideration. And you can be on lots of drugs, but again, you come back to a zone of comparison test with irrelevance and pre-stress and control and relevant questions. And in order for him to have a deceptive indicated test, he has to have stressed in those relevant questions what we call distress, which would be significantly greater physiological responses than what you would see in a control of pre-stress or you know, even a forced lie or an irrelevant. But I'm reminded when you say that, John DeLorean, I was one of those people involved in DeLorean's lie detection test.
Uh-huh,
this way.
Okay.
This way. I'm not going to name the examiner. I'll keep us both out of trouble here. But the examiner initially examined DeLorean and said, clean, clear to Flagtown. He's telling the truth. He doesn't know anything about these drugs. Okay? I saw the video of that. In the video, DeLorean is all over. He's taking very obvious countermeasures, and the examiner is ignoring them all. To the extent that we filed charges against that examiner.
Wow.
You can have an examiner, for whatever reason, maybe they're asleep at the wheel, maybe, you know,
mesmerized by the person, right?
I'm not going to attempt to come up with what their motive is, but examiners can do a very poor job. And I remember a homicide case that I was called into. A young man was actually in prison for the brutal murder of his mother. And part of the reason he was imprisoned is because he'd been given a lie detection test. He'd failed the lie detection test. He was then told, look, you know, if you cop to this, we can make it easier on you and da-da-da. So he had pled guilty. Well, this wasn't the brightest young man on the planet, and he'd been doing alcohol and drugs that night, but he didn't kill his mother. But the test he took was a simple two-needle test. There were only, you know, two different measurements on. This was a homicide in a state that required a minimum of four different measurements to the polygraph. I ran my own lie detection test on him, and the kid passed it. I did forensic hypnosis on him, and he could tell me things that happened that night that we were able to verify that placed him elsewhere. One of the things is a case where he had no conscious recollection without the hypnosis, but he told us under hypnosis how he'd been cutting through a park on his way home because he'd found his mother and reported the crime, called law enforcement. And he saw a police officer pull into the park. So he hid behind this bench and watched this police officer get out of his car, search the trash, call in, go back to the trash, get back in the car, and then leave. Well, it was easy enough for us to check the police logs and the timing that was involved to verify whether or not that happened, because that placed him in the park. And it placed him in the park at the time of the murder, and with the distance, et cetera, it was part of the it was part of the evidence that we used to reverse the decision and see that this young man was freed. So you can have bad examiners, you can have bad equipment, but if you have a deception-indicated test, again, you don't have reason to believe you. You may question it. You may ask him to take another test, but you have no reason to believe the person.
Absolutely. Did you do any work with reverse speech at all?
I did, indeed. You know, I stumbled onto that one. One of the instruments that I used to use was called, I still have it, is called a psychological stress evaluator. And what it does is it looks for a muscle microtremor that accompanies all voluntary muscle movement. we would record all of our examinations, and the recording device or tool was a Uhair recorder, a reel-to-reel recorder like you used to see on television when you saw spy movies. And we would record at 15, 16 inches per second. Because it was recorded that way, I could, you know, back it up just with my finger, back up a simple answer, and in one little quarter turn, get somebody's answer. The first time I encountered this, I had a lie detection examination with a deceptive indicated chart. It was a simple crime. I think it was a theft. And the relevant question, did you take the missing money? When I reversed his no, it said liar.
My gosh.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was so, whoa. I had to get everybody to listen to it because I just reversed it with my finger.
You couldn't believe it.
Liar. Liar. Now, he later gave us a confession, and we had a recovery. So I know the liar is good, but at the time I encountered it, I thought, boy, isn't that ever a strange
coincidence. Why can't you hear that with the human ear at that time, before it's reversed?
Well, you know, I had a station out of Ohio. Gosh, I guess it was in the early 90s. KCNI, I believe is what it was. I could check that. But it was a station out of Ohio contact me and say, Madonna's new release has some backmasked, reversed subliminal messages in it. And could you verify that for us? And so I had him send me in the soundtrack. We reversed the soundtrack, and sure enough, it had satanic lyrics.
Amazing. Let's talk more about that and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your phone calls in just a second. Back to reverse speech, Eldon. You were talking about Madonna's.
Yeah, and because of the break, I was able to double-check. It was WNCI that contacted me. But what they said was they'd heard a rumor that there was backward masking in Justify My Love in her songs, Madonna's, in the song Like a Prayer and in the song Rescue Me. And when I reversed it, it was clear. I mean, in Rescue Me, the lyrics were in the midnight smoke of yellow. Hear my melodies. Hail to the family. It must be unknown. Hail, hallelujah, my position. In Justifying My Love, I love Satan. Do you? I love Satan. Who are you? And I could go on. But the bottom line is we were able to find these reversals, play them clearly, play them on the air for WNCI clearly. Later, and the story got larger, obviously, I ended up taking a lot of phone calls, but later the Madonna people stepped out and said, yeah, they'd done it. They'd done it intentionally. It was a part of a promotional plan. Now, the reason, your question was, why don't we hear that in forward speech?
Yeah.
Well, we don't. There's a lot of things we don't hear. We know that in perceptual cueing, we can create conflict. We can have someone mouth the word ga and say the word ba, and you will perceive that to be some combination thereof, like da. Okay?
Good.
So you have a perceptual conflict. There's a simple experiment that you can do with anyone. Take a headline of a newspaper, step back to where you think you're out of their visual range, and hold it up. And if they can read that, then back up just a little bit more and put another one up. If they can read that, back up until you're just outside of their range of what they can read. They can't read it at all. Then you read it to them, and you watch how quickly they can see it. If you know what's there, you see it. If you don't, you don't. We know that about our senses. The same is true with our hearing. I can tell you a story in one ear. This is part of what's known as dichotic masking. In fact, it's technology. It underlies some of what we do. But I can tell you a story in one ear and give you random numbers in the other ear. Switch. Let the story go to the opposite ear and random numbers go to the opposite ear. You will hear the story and not hear the random numbers. The mind has an absolute necessity to make sense out of the world.
It tunes it. Yeah.
That's right. So we hear I do believe that we have, if you will, parapraxis or Freudian slips in both forward and reverse speech. We all know what a Freudian is in forward speech. Somebody says something that is very relevant. It is a slip from the unconscious, but they sure didn't intend to say it. But we have that going on in reverse speech at the same time. David Oates has done a lot of work in that area.
Mm-hmm.
That's really his thing. I've done a lot of research with reverse speech and to the extent of how we use it. But David, as opposed to looking at it the way I do, looks at it from where does it come from, what is it saying. I think he's still teaching courses on it. David used to be a regular guest on Art Bell Show. Was it a long time ago?
Yeah.
Well, but reverse speech is very credible, and anybody that wants to do this can do it. You just simply record, some conversation, slow it down about 10%, play it in reverse, and you will find meaningful reversal.
It is amazing. I mean, they're trying to do it now with politicians and people like that, and it's something.
It really is, and one of the things that that I get criticized. In fact, I've had a friend. I have a friend. I shouldn't say had a friend. I have a friend.
He's still ticking.
Yeah, he's still kicking. Professor emeritus that said to me, Eldon, I don't know if they're going to think you're crazy or if you're going to win a Nobel for this, but I truly believe, and I have positioned most of my work around this, that we have what I've described as a mirror imaging paradigm in how we process information. We learn that information in reverse. As young children, we are right hemisphere oriented completely. It's all about spatial, face recognition, etc. We are not left hemisphere in the sense of the literal, the linear, the language oriented. And in this spatial way, we actually holographically mirror that information. And the research supports that we are mirroring information across the brain. And in early children, I mean, when children are developing and they have these early signs of dyslexia where they reverse an S or they reverse a 5, and they're perfect mirror images, hold them to a mirror, to me that is evidence of that. And I've actually worked with some of those instances and been able to satisfy them. But the real meaningful ones is if every parent that's had a child knows that the child comes to a stage where they're going to look you in the eye and they're going to say something. And whatever they're saying, you don't understand a word of it. But it's not goo goo gaga. It's not babble talk. It would seem to be something very serious. It seems to have its consonants and its vowels, but you don't understand it. Well, if you record that and play it in reverse, slowing it down just a little, it's meaningful speech.
That's great.
And it's incredible. And as far as I'm concerned, David is due a whole lot of recognition for pioneering that field, but it is very definitely a real...
It's a science.
Yes, it is.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dwayne in Fresno, California, west of the Rockies. Hello, Dwayne, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I was wondering, you were speaking earlier about a flu or some sort of sickness back in the day that killed a lot of people.
1918.
Okay. I was wondering if the swine flu is like a buildup due to the fact of the Illuminati wanting to knock off, their downsizing of the people.
Well, I don't know about that. You never know about that.
No, there are lots of conspiracy theories out there. Is it a population control thing? That's not my thing. I'd have to pass that one to you, George. I hear about those kinds of things. I hear about them because a lot of people that I associate with are involved or have had some history in them, but it's not my area of expertise.
Wouldn't you love to strap a lie detector test to all these governmental leaders? All of them.
I absolutely would. There's no question about wanting to
publicize it. It should be part of the election campaign.
Yeah. ideally, what I'd really like to do, George, is get him in a situation where you can give him the test, you can put a little stress to him, you can take the recorded statements, and you can play those recorded statements in reverse, and you can use the combination of the tools, you know? So when this person says to you, I'm going to lower taxes, what does he really mean, you know?
Exactly. Next up, let's go to Gulfport, Mississippi, east of the Rockies. Hey, Michael.
Good morning, George, Ms. Taylor.
How are you, sir?
George, you can turn the camera off now. It's very hot and humid down here tonight. Mr. Taylor, I remember when they used to put every few frames in a movie a picture of an ice thing of Coca-Cola and popcorn and then turn you loose to the concession stand. And I started reading about that. I believe they call it sublime suggestion.
Subliminal suggestion.
Subliminal. That's it.
Yeah,
okay.
And that was James Vickery, purportedly. He claimed that he did it. If I can just slow you down for a second, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed that he did it. He had a business called Precon Processing that manufactured a device that he had patented. And that device allowed for you to be able to put these subliminal messages in the movies, and he claimed that he had done it on the movie Picnic. He'd flash Coca-Cola on Kim Novak's face, thirsty, drink Coca-Cola, hungry, eat popcorn. He claimed concession sales increases that were just astronomical. But then there was an uproar about that. Later, in 1984, in the congressional hearings, he denied that he'd ever done it. We don't know to this day if he really did it. You will see there are those out there that would like to tell you that there is no such thing as a subliminal communication, no such thing as mind or brainwashing, et cetera, and so forth. Those people will tell you this is a great hoax. It never happened. Vickery denied it. He did deny it in 1984, but Michael, he had the technology. There is no question about that. He had the patent. We've looked at that. There is no question about whether or not he had the ability. There's only a question is, did he really do it, or is this really one of those urban legends? But go on. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to kind of clarify that history.
Well, I guess he went on his own. That's okay.
I'm sorry, Michael.
That's all right. Subliminal programming with, let's say, edited frames of one or two frames, primarily for video or television.
Mm-hmm.
Why does that seem to register in the mind?
Well, the whys of it, we're not really certain. This we do know, however, it is prioritized by way of information. You know, lots of research has been done with that. Postel did work way back at the turn of the century, the last century, the 20th century, not this century, where just quick flashes of frames would produce dreams that vented those images. Mechanics, the actual mechanics as to why the brain prioritizes that, you know, that's anybody's good guess. But the brain does register it, and it does prioritize it. It does bring that information back. And repeated studies, and there are the studies now and the data is so robust that to me it's undeniable. A meta-analysis of hundreds of studies conclusively show effect from these kinds of presentations. Indeed, there was a recent study where if you put a frown on a product, just put a frown on a product, put a smile on another product, what we learned is we could actually increase the amount of money you were willing to spend for a product because the subliminal face, the smile was associated, or it would decrease what you would spend because this subliminal frown. There are different kinds of subliminal, though, too. There's also this whole idea of linking images. So it's no surprise that when they ran the studies, the Apple logo generates more creativity than the IBM logo.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
That was all over the news. What might surprise a lot of people is that when you look at these kinds of associations, if there's a credit card, a picture of a credit card in a room that you're asked to make a donation, you're going to make a significantly larger donation than if we remove the picture of that credit card.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Well, it's all planned. You know, nowadays, the color has been decided by some psychometric, level of interaction with someone, particularly in places like restaurants. The pictures, the themes, all of these things are planned out. They're planned out very, very carefully where hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be spent in some kind of an advertising campaign.
Next up, we'll go to Miami Beach in Florida. George, it's your turn. Hey, George, good morning.
Hey, George, Tocayo, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead, George.
Okay. The question I have for this gentleman is, there was a movie in 1966 called Looker with James Coburn in it, and it was a sci-fi movie about a thing where they had a gun that would flash you with light and you would be paralyzed. But they also had it, the technology that was also available in film, that you watch a film and it would brainwash you.
A brainwashing?
Yeah. Is that available these days, you think, that the technology has caught up to that?
Do we have that kind of technology, brainwashing technology with special instruments?
Yeah, you know, the answer to that is yes. The technology technically exists, but what you have to do is you have to change the context. What we know about those kinds of studies is this. You hear hypnotists all the time say you will do nothing under hypnosis that you wouldn't otherwise do. And that's not technically correct. If they were to say you won't do anything under hypnosis under normal circumstances that you wouldn't otherwise do, I'd go along with that. But hypnosis has been in research back in the 60s showed us that you can use hypnosis over extended periods of time to alter personalities, to even split and create multiple personalities. Indeed, in Project Bluebird, the entire project of the U.S. government was designed to create an assassin. And what they learned is if they could create multiple personalities, they could create these Manchurian candidates. When you isolate a person for a while and you begin then to reframe their context, you show them, if you will, movies or films that contain a great deal of propaganda, propaganda that you've decided would move them to the belief perspective that you had. Let's take, for example, a conflict maybe with an imaginary opponent where that opponent wants to convince you that you're the terrorist, they're not the terrorist, and they show activities by your country that are killing children and women, and they show statements taken out of context that would make your allegiances be the perpetrators of great evil in the world. And this is done systematically while other physiological things are involved. What we know is that we can, in fact, change your sphere of influence and, if you will, brainwash you, not unlike cults do, to where, as in the instance with the Korean War, our soldiers, some of them were actually stepping forward, making statements that were anti-American, and they maintained those statements even when they came home and had been fully debriefed.
Amazing. Next up, final question before the break. We'll go to Long Island, New York. Carl, take it away.
Yes, hi. First time, long time. Really is an honor to speak to you, George, and you as well, Elvin.
Thank you very much.
Just a really quick comment and a question. Microsoft Windows comes with, games like Solitaire and things like that. It also comes with a program which is called Microphone, and I've experimented in the past with just recording something, either playing guitar or just singing, and they have just a little feature where you can reverse it. So that's something maybe people can play with on their own. But my question for you, Eldon, is have you ever heard of playing Pink Floyd album and queuing it up with The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of this?
Yes, I have. In fact,
Dark Side of the Moon, and it's supposed to be, I guess, the third time the lion roars. And the thing to me is it's just so incredible that so many things happen where it really couldn't have been by coincidence, and just the talent and the genius of them to be able to do something like that is really remarkable. I'd like to just hear your comments on it. Thank you, Alvin.
Thank you. I totally agree with you, Carl. I look at that, however, and Pink Floyd is full. It's rich. That's why everybody cranks it up, even if they don't understand why they're cranking it up. But I look at that as an artistic license. You know, these are musicians.
Very creative people.
Yeah, they're working very hard to give you a product that you just love, and you're going to play it over and over and over again.
And they know what buttons to push. We'll be back with final phone calls with Eldon Taylor in just a moment. Mind Programming on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your final phone calls. Eldon, I got to tell you, very compelling interview with you. Just great information.
Well, thank you, sir. I enjoy this very much. We could do this, you know, on and on. I tell you, I've got to say this to you. You know, one of the things that I find to be the most rewarding aspect of my life is the ability to communicate with, you know, bright people that are there. I mean, just, you know, you have that conversation. I often think of, you know, people like Isaac Newton. You know, here's Haley. He's having coffee, the story goes, with a couple of friends, and they're trying to figure out whether or not the planets are in an elliptical orbit or non-elliptical. So Haley runs over to Newton, sits down in his home, they have coffee, they chat, and Newton says, oh, you know, I figured that out some time ago, but I've lost the papers. he finds the papers for Haley, and of course it's Mathematica Principia. You know, it turns the world upside down. But what was going on was you had two people who shared a common interest, who had a dialogue, they had a conversation, and I enjoy that more than anything in my life. And George Nuri, I could have this conversation with you here on the radio. I could have it with you in a lounge. I could have it with you at my dining room table. I love it. It's just fun.
You know, and I think that's what makes this so refreshing. It's like we are at your dining room table. By the way, pass the turkey, would you?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Tampa, Florida we go. First-time caller, Dan, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Dan.
Yes, your guest kind of reminds me of, Richard C. Hoagland a little bit, the voice.
Yeah, a little bit, a little kind of similar.
Yeah, but as far as my question goes, you know, I was on hold for probably about 20 minutes, and it changed a little bit. I was originally going to ask about the reverse speech and stuff like that, but I kind of generalized the question altogether. I'm wondering just basically if you could actually go, or if you could explain possibly you know, how you can actually go and try to pinpoint and find out with things like reverse speech and possibly like ads on television and stuff like that. If you could go somehow and pick apart maybe an ad from TV that has subliminal messages like right in the video ads, how can you actually go and pinpoint those and say, hey, you know, there it is right there. Do you have to like slow it down or something?
Good point. Good question.
Yeah, you do, Dan. And what you do, you know, let's harken back to Bush, President Bush, and his campaign against Al Gore. And what did he do? Well, his people put the word rats right over the top of Al Gore's head in a commercial, and that you know, was subliminal. It flashed so quickly, we didn't see that. His people, when first asked about it, said, oh, you know, it's an accident. It's really the rats out of Democrats and da-da-da-da-da. They eventually admitted it. And by the way, there were no penalties ever imposed on him. Most people think there are laws against that, but they aren't. But what you have to do in order to discover it is look at it frame by frame. And you have to look at the sound almost frame by frame, too. You have to slow it down. You look at a visual of the sound, and you're looking at how you reverse that sound, and you're slowing down all of the sound at the same time. It can take hours to look at just a very short piece, but that's what you have to do, Dan. Now, while we're before I leave Bush and his rats ad, I have to also add this. There has been a good study run since then to see could that have been a influencing factor on the electorate. And indeed, the study shows that it did influence all subjects who participated in a like presentation under controlled circumstances. So, you know, we have an ad. You remember how close that election was, and it may well have been tipped by that ad. I can tell you firsthand, I have had politicians contact my office and ask us to do those kinds of things. And when they learn that, as far as I'm concerned, if they do that, they have to tell the public they're doing it. It's informed consent. They go away. Does that answer your question, Dan?
It does. You know what I heard from David Icke was actually on the show a while back. I just want to say this real quick before you guys let me go. I know you got other callers. He actually said that some of the actual news agencies and stuff like that actually send out some of the stuff to specific organizations to throw in subliminal messages before they actually put it on air. Do you know anything about what David Icke said about that? And I'll actually take my answer off the air.
Okay, Daniel. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, the answer to that is yes. If you looked at this last election cycle, you would see that the Learning Channel flashed the face of Obama during a Progressive Insurance ad. Obama's face was flashed on Discovery TV between Dirty Jobs, the series Dirty Jobs, and an ad for DirecTV Visa card. McCain, in one of his ads, had the word change blacked out behind Obama to where what you saw was the word hang with a front script reading higher taxes. There was a station in Minneapolis, a Fox affiliate, I think it was KM. Well, I'm just going to say it was a Fox affiliate in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Is that KMSP?
Yeah, that's who it is.
Obama's face in the background
during a sex offender story. You know, all of these people will tell you when you find these things that it's an accident, but it's no accident. I mean, those kind of you can't have that kind of an accident. If you know how you put video together, you're not going to have that kind of accident.
Amazing. Let's go next to St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Boy, this is a fascinating topic. I couldn't agree with you more. My question, I guess, almost follows on the last one. Assuming that this is being done, and it has to be done intentionally, as you just said, it can't possibly be an accident. If anyone ever were able to get the ear of the American public, so to speak, I mean a really honest, independent sort of a person, how could they ever overcome all this huge money and huge professional technique of putting the subliminal advertising and all the rest? How could they ever even have a competitive possibility by being just honest with people and not utilizing all these techniques?
You know, I'm not sure that I can give you an answer on that, Kevin, but I can tell you it is an experiment in process. My book, Mind Programming, gives you the names, the dates, the places, the times. It gives you the inside declassified. It gives you the firsthand testimony. It gives you their training manual. It spells it all out. And the whole intent of writing this book is to say to everybody, wake up. Wake up. Have you got any idea what's being done to you? Do you know where you're marching and who's playing the drum? And maybe, I guess, Kevin, maybe a year or 2 years from now I'll be able to answer that question for you. I know this. Once upon a time, I was one of the expert witnesses in the Judas Priest case, the now infamous Judas Priest case. Howard Chevron was a witness there. In 1984, Chevron testified that subliminal had an effect. We processed it, but he didn't think it influenced behavior. When we got to Reno, Nevada, he and I both testified. Not only did it influence behavior, not only had we both our own backgrounds of research and the studies and the cases to show, but that it was the particular subliminal command that was embedded in the Stained Glass album, in the piece Better By You, Better Than Me, which overtly, the lyrics overtly encourage suicide, the command, do it, do it, which was chanted by the two young men before they shot themselves, was a causal factor. And I can tell you this, CBS was fined over and over by the judge for manipulating the press, and they really go after assassinating character. So the powers that be can decide that this is something that they don't want out there, and they can really come after you. You know, the bottom line is some of us are willing to say, here's where it is. George Nuri is doing that by having me on his show. This is where it is, and I'm happy to back it up at any time, anywhere, any place.
If you were trying to change the perception of the American people to start buying again, Eldon, what would you do? How would you do it?
I'd begin to tell them good things about the economy. I'd begin to focus on what is going right in the economy. I'd begin to point out that the market, as a case in point, has now had 6 weeks of upward gains. That it's low in the 7,000s is probably well behind us. I'd show them those charts. I begin to talk to them about the profits that retailers are experiencing. Everyone expected last month's retail numbers to come in with great sales decreases, and they came in overall up, not just Walmart, but all of them overall up. I begin to talk about all of the positive aspects of the economy, reinforcing the idea that, you know, unemployment is dropping, new claims have diminished, we're seeing growth back. You know, we've seen a slowdown in the depreciation of homes. If we focus on that, which is all factual, the economy will turn.
You
given
know,
the power and the pulpit of the presidency, if it were to come from there, it would turn very, very quickly.
You know, and if I were GM and Chrysler, I would have come out with a public relations campaign and an advertising blitz, pulling out historical pictures of American workers, maybe even black and white stuff, of you know, the old classic cars and, you know, just the American feeling of what we were and that we're still strong and we're still here, and change the perception of people rather than what they did, which was basically nothing.
Well, they run and they hid. And what they did is they took, you know, they as they say in the UK, they went on the dole. They started taking the federal monies, and then, of course, the reorganization, the firing of, the CEO, and of course, everything is downhill. But when you say that, who's missing the bet is Ford Motor right now. Ford Motor has not capitalized on this great opportunity.
Absolutely. They didn't take any money.
Well, they didn't take the money, and they're strong. Yeah, actually, Ford Motor saw something coming, and they went out there and they cashed in their lines of credit. They filled their cash coffers, and they've been able to operate from that when there was no money available, when it all dried up and those lines of credits went away. General Motors found themselves in deep trouble, as did Chrysler. But Ford had the deep pockets. They had the cash. They'd already drawn off it. But what they're not doing is getting out there saying, you know, we're healthy. We've been here since. We were the first. You know?
I'd pull out old Henry Ford footage and,
you
know, everything.
You're right. And
the Model T.
And you would be very successful with that campaign.
Yeah, I think so, too. Maybe they're listening to us, Eldon. They'll go with it. They don't have to send us anything. Let's go to Syracuse, New York, east of the Rockies. Hello, Brad. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
George, I've had a lot of fun with your joke about the gates of heaven, the three unusual stories you told earlier. it's a gas. And I just wanted to tell you, I know you don't believe in coincidences, but a friend of mine told me a coincidence is God working anonymously. That's what he told me.
Could be.
And if you ever want to try something, ask somebody, say, are you afraid of rats, and look at them. And then try it the next time with a person. Say, are you afraid of rats, and look at their feet. And the reaction is completely different, you know. But my question to you is it possible when you watch watched Nancy Pelosi talk about the fact that she wasn't told about the waterboarding actually being used in government, is it possible that they can remove something from your memory in case they ever get put on a lie detector test to use that?
Good question. Can you become the Manchurian candidate, Elder?
You know, let's set Nancy Pelosi aside, Brad, and let's just think about the question theoretically. Theoretically, is it possible? Yes. Look, you know, we can have a multiple personality disordered patient. In one personality, they have normal blood sugar. Snap your fingers, their personality changed, and they're hypoglycemic. Indeed, in one personality, the eye color is blue. Snap your fingers, the next personality, the eye color is brown. I mean, that's supposed to be fixed. I mean, DNA doesn't change. We all know that. But the fact is it does. So if I can create multiple personalities, which, you know, for all intent and purposes was the work of Estabrooks at Colgate College, if I can create these multiple personalities, then one of them can be an assassin, and that assassin is ignorant of the other. The other can be a normal human being just walking down the street, minding their business, working their job, dishing donuts or whatever, and totally ignorant of the assassin personality until it is triggered.
Maybe that's what happened to Oswald, too.
There have been arguments that indeed he was one of those candidates. That's not, if you get on the internet, you'll see that that is a major conspiracy theory. So we do know, and I cover this in the book, Brad, that you can do that. Now, where Nancy Pelosi is concerned, forgive me for this, but if you look at her body movement, if you look at how she articulates her answers to the press, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I don't think you need a lie detection test. I'm pretty sure this woman was briefed. She's hiding something.
Oh, man. Included in Mind Programming, you have a CD. What is that?
Yeah, it's one of the InterTalk CDs, George. You know, along the way in doing this work at the prison system is a case in point where we started. We designed some technology. The technology was effective. We began to roll that technology out. Today it's called InterTalk. It's a form of dichotic masking, a subliminal type of program. In the book, you know, what I wanted to do was give everyone that bought the book a sample. You know, here it is. This is what the product or what a product is, and the proof is in the pudding. Obviously, you can't give everybody weight loss or everybody smoking. So in this day and age, serenity. You know, we all need a break from the stress. We can all stand that calm, feels good. And so that's a program that we put in it. The CD sells by itself for $27.95. The book is on sale, I think, at Amazon right now and Barnes & Noble for like $16, $17. So you can really get them both if you buy it online, really.
That's a great deal. And, I've got to tell you, it's a great read. It's a fascinating subject. And you know what? We need more people like you in this country, Eldon, who just say it the way you see it.
Well, thank you very much, sir. We need more people like you that are willing to expose it and make it available to everybody.
Well, we're not going to stop. Eldon, thanks so much. Anytime you need us, you just get a hold of us.
I'll do that. Thank you very much, George.
Eldon Taylor. It's called Mind Programming, and let me tell you, it's a pretty good book. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. And what a dandy it will be. Until then, be safe, everyone.